Hi, I'm Stephanie Marland, and welcome to the My Little Eye podcast. My Little Eye is my new thriller coming on the 5th of April, and it's about a group of true crime addicts who meet online and attempt to catch a serial killer before the police. So what better reason to put together an online crime podcast series? In each episode, I'm going to be chatting with expert guests about murder, crime, and the facts behind the fiction. Today, I'm joined by Rob, a former police officer with a background in specialist firearms. Me and Rob met through a friend and have known each other for about 10 years now. So, welcome, Rob. Tell me a bit about your career.
Recently finished in the Metropolitan Police after serving 30 years. Most of my experience was along the lines of specialist firearms.
Cool. So when we've chatted before, you've often spoken about the strong camaraderie in the police. Can you tell us a bit about what it's like to be in a specialist team?
It's very different from being a relief officer. The guys and girls who become part of specialist teams, whether that's in specialist firearms or specialist crime, they tend to have a they will have a certain level of experience before they become suitable for specialisation. Then most of them will go through some sort of rigorous selection process, and then certainly on the side of specialist firearms, quite a difficult training process.
Right.
So at the time that those men and women join those specialist teams, you've got a lot of very capable, competent people. The very nature of my background and the teams that I worked with, the rank system wasn't as important as it would be for a young, inexperienced police officer. Police in the streets of London on a response team where you've got a level of inexperience, different capabilities, where you need that stronger delineation of the rank structure.
Right,
the specialist
okay.
team, it's more role-specific than rank-specific. For example, when I went back onto specialist firearms as an inspector, I'd been out of the firearms world for several years. So I reapplied, been recoursed. But then when I hit the ground running with the team that I was working with PCs and sergeants who were very, very experienced, very capable, very competent. So it's not a case of putting your authority as a sergeant or inspector, it's being an effective and efficient member of the team.
Right.
And the ranks, as I said, the rank structures, it's far less important, and it's more about the roles that you're doing within specific operations. There always will be that that separation with command and control on the role I was in was slightly different to the PCs, but a lot of the work that you do tends to be quite high risk and high threat.
Okay.
So you tend to need to trust the people that you work with. So the very nature of that. And of course, you're working with the same people day in, day out. So that team bonding is quite close. Part of it out of necessity, and part is because you are, by the nature of the job, working with those same people all the time.
Yeah, and you've obviously got a lot of experience in policing. You were in the force for a long time. How have you seen the rise of social media changing the way the police operate?
It's more of an issue on the criminal investigation side, but it's been huge. It widens up the investigative opportunities. Witness information may become apparent by monitoring social media, which when I first joined the police, there wasn't anything about social media. It just didn't happen. A lot more intelligence now. Social media brings a huge amount of information, a lot of opportunity to link individuals and groups through social media. So whether they be loosely knit criminal gangs or organised criminal networks, a lot of work can be done on social media. It increases the volume of crime when you look at bullying, harassment, stalking, fraud, which has always been a huge problem, is now compounded massively by social media. You can, apart from the obvious criminal side of it, you've got the incitement side. Look at the riots that happened in London several years ago. Now, a lot of that was fueled by social media and incitement in social media. There's a lot of misinformation as well. So a lot of high profile incidents. People can be antagonized by misinformation on social media sites. Then there's the other side of it when you look at how discipline procedures need to be maintained within the service, because you could have a lot of the younger guys and girls now who live their life on social media will make statements about each other or make accusations which then come back to haunt them on professional standards investigations. Because what once would have been a conversation, now it's done in social media. And once it's posted online, it's there to stay. It's a huge impact for the service.
Yeah, big changes. And obviously, you know, you've given me lots of advice around writing my crime fiction. But we in crime fiction often speed up the process, the investigation process, just for the, you know, for the story, to keep the pace of the book. But are there any kind of commonly made mistakes about policing that you see in books or TV that really irritate you?
Do you know, I think that people from any professional background, when they see something that happens in, whether it's on TV or in books, it's the same for me as it is for nurses watching Casualty or teachers watching Teachers. And when you identify things which procedurally aren't right, you switch off. Personally, I look at something which is doesn't ring true to me, and I think, well, that person hasn't done their homework.
Mm.
So the research isn't very good. So why should I give any credence to this bit of escapism when it doesn't follow what really happens? Maybe I shouldn't say it, but Line of Fire, it was lauded to me as you've got to watch it. It's a fantastic program. I watched the first 2-3 minutes of the first episode and I switched it off because the deployment of the armed officers there was fantasy. The way which it was done, the lack of professionalism, the way in which even the grammatical content of the command of it was just bizarre, and I just couldn't take it seriously.
So it just sort of stops you watching.
It just stops it completely, yeah. Because it there's absolutely no credibility.
Mm.
There has to be some sort of poetic license, but when it is so clearly seems to be written or directed by somebody who hasn't had any person with knowledge advising them, it just ruins it for me.
Yeah. I can see on your face you're not happy about it.
But again, I said that'd be the same with any other profession. Speak to a nurse or a casualty, and they wouldn't, or Holby sitting, they would undoubtedly have similar opinions to myself.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, one of the, that sort of leads me quite neatly into my next question. So in My Little Eye, D.I. Bell, my detective, struggles to identify the killer and is also harried by an internal investigation. Police officers in fiction are regularly portrayed as stressed, burnt-out figures. Would you say that this stereotype is true to life?
I think on TV and film, I think it makes good drama. And I can see why, you know, you have that stressed detective and, you know, the public are rooting for somebody who's facing adversity and then getting through it. And I understand that. The reality is, I think people can get quite severely stressed, especially when it's an investigation which gets under their skin. And whereas you can try and be impartial and separate yourself from it, sometimes you just can't. Some cases are so gut-wrenching that you can't help but be affected by it.
Of course.
And I think workload can be huge. Workload can drive people to immense amounts of stress, especially when it's extended hours at work, domestic difficulties, because you're never at home. You're always working on your rest days. You're working extended hours. There are certainly real issues that a lot of people in the public don't understand and maybe would like to appreciate, but unless you're going through it, you don't get it. On the flip side, there are a few officers who will play the stress card when really they're just not good enough to do the job, or maybe a little incompetent. So I've seen both sides.
Mm.
People who have been quite significantly affected and those who are just trying to play the system.
And do you have a kind of favourite fictional police character?
Have you watched The Wire?
I have, yeah. Big fan of The Wire.
Jimmy McNulty.
Oh, brilliant,
He is a composite of so many cops. And I don't care whether you work in Baltimore or Brixton.
Yeah.
Police are police. And that character will resonate with so many people.
Yeah.
There's so many things that have happened in The Wire when you look at it and think, that's true, that's happened. You can clearly see that The Wire has been written by, well, it was an ex-Baltimore cop and a newspaper reporter who wrote it together. And you can see that in the way they write it.
Yeah, it's an amazing series.
McNulty is, I look at close friends of mine and say, you there's a bit of Jimmy in you.
Brilliant. And so I've got a final question now that I'm going to close with. So this was submitted via Twitter. So brace yourself. This is from @JBonningtonJag. And they ask, is it true that after a murder hitting the news, people queue up at the local police station to confess to a crime?
Well, that's something I've never experienced. But I was mindful of a conversation with a close friend of mine who's a DI when we did talk about this. And what he said is that you will have fantasists who will wish to admit to killings that they clearly didn't commit.
Okay.
Almost always these people have mental health issues. It's frustrating because that confession still has to be investigated while those officers should be doing something genuine.
Mm.
Quite often you will have people who will come to the police station and confess to a murder, but this is particularly if it's, for example, a domestic-oriented murder.
Right.
An argument between a couple has got out of hand, somebody's committed an offence, which they've immediately thought, and they've gone to the police.
Right.
But you certainly don't have queues of people queuing outside
Brixton
Police Station
right.
confessing to murders. Funny that was the case.
Okay. Well, I mean, a huge thanks to Rob for joining me today. Be sure to join me next week for another episode of the My Little Eye podcast. But first, here's a short extract from the audiobook, which is available to buy now.
Kate can still feel his touch on her skin. He only held her hand. No, less than that. He put his hand over hers just for a few seconds. Nothing in the grand scheme of things. A comforting gesture because she was upset, that was all, she tells herself. A few days ago, he'd walked into the break room at work just as she'd hung up on Mart after yet another argument. He'd seen she was crying and he'd held her hand. A totally normal thing between colleagues. No, friends. Since then, she's thought about that moment, their moment, a lot. It felt exciting, and she hasn't felt excitement for what seems like forever. She liked the feeling. A part of her wants to feel it again. She refuses to feel guilty about it. She's almost at the flat now. She looks up at the first floor out of habit, expecting to see darkness. But there is a soft glow behind the curtains, a light on inside. She frowns. Wasn't Mark working tonight? She's sure he'd said he had a late set at the club. Wasn't that why he'd waved away her excuses for doing overtime on the late shift? Hadn't he said he didn't care? Setting the two jute bags of groceries down on the step, she fumbles in her jacket pocket for her keys. Her hands are numb from the cold and it takes her a couple of attempts to grasp them. She adds buy gloves to her mental to-do list. The folks back home had told her it never got properly cold in central London. Now, in the middle of the dark, rainy November, Kate knows they were talking bollocks. She unlocks the door, picks up the bags and pushes the door open with her shoulder. As it closes behind her, the automatic light in the communal hallway comes on. She blinks at the brightness reflected back from the cerise-painted walls, sidesteps around the upstairs neighbour's bike and heads towards the stairs. Glancing at the stacks of mail on the tatty side table as she passes, she spots a pile for her and Mart. "Fuck's sake," Kate mutters, snatching it up. "Do I have to do everything?" She leafs through the envelopes, two bills and a piece of junk mail, plus what looks like a credit card statement for Mart with final demand stamped in angry red across the top of the envelope. She sighs, shakes her head. He really is crap with money. Tucking the post under her arm, she picks up her bags and trudges towards the stairs. She starts working out how much cash she's got stashed away across her savings accounts, the one he knows about and the other two. No matter what her mum tells her about Mark being a rubbish freeloader and that she deserves better, Kate has always bailed him out. She knows he thinks she will again. But that would mean she can't have that holiday in Dubai she's been saving for. The thought of having to stay in cold, damp London all winter pisses her off even more. The bags feel heavier, her legs more tired. She tries to remember if there is any wine in the fridge. She has a horrible feeling the answer is no. Sod it. She won't bail him out again. She's going to Dubai with Eva. Reaching the door to the flat, she drops the bags again and undoes the lock. Pushing the bags inside with her foot, she enters and closes the door behind her, calling, "Hey, Ma, I'm back." No reply. "Great," she thinks, hoisting up the bags again. "Don't tell me, will you?" Since they've been living together, he's treated her more like his mum or housekeeper than his girlfriend. When they first moved in, they split all the chores down the middle. He cleaned and shopped, she cooked and did the ironing. Now he's always too busy with his music, the implication being that what she does is less important, that he thinks she is less important. Kate pushes open the door into the living area, halts a few steps inside. The corner lamp is on, the low lighting giving the place a dusky haze. Two glasses of red wine are sitting on the glass top of the coffee table. There's music playing over Mart's high-end speakers, some ballad from the 80s that she vaguely recognises as one her dad likes. Not Mart's usual kind of tune, but maybe he's trying to be retro and romantic. It's been a while since he made that kind of effort. The sweet love notes and surprise gifts of their early days are long in the past. "Mart?" she says. Nothing. She puts the bags down and takes a few more steps into the room. Listens hard, but can't hear him. "Mart, where are you?" Still nothing. Kate moves forward to the coffee table and picks up a glass. Takes a sip of wine. It's the good stuff. Delicious. She needs it after doing a double shift. Needs it to help her forget the handholding and remind herself not to feel guilty, more guilty. She takes another sip and glances around the room again. That's when she notices the red splodges on the carpet near the bedroom door. The door is ajar, a chink of light visible through the gap. As she draws closer, she recognises what the splodges are. Her heartbeat quickens. Guilt tightens in her chest. This is big, unexpected. Kate stares at the rose petals scattered around the entrance to the bedroom and wonders what got into Mart to go for such a grand gesture. Whatever's caused it, it's about time. She'd been thinking the relationship was on its way out, but if he's making this amount of effort, maybe they still have a chance. "Mart?" she says, her tone soft, playful. The bedroom door opens halfway. Kate gasps. The cream duvet on their bed is strewn with rose petals. Candles encircle the iron bedstead in flickering light. "Mart, it's beautiful!" She steps onto the threshold, transfixed. Remembers the good times, sharing candlelit baths, talking for hours about anything and everything. Mart is the guy for her. This proves it. She wonders if he's about to propose. Kate takes another pace forward. "This is amazing! Where did you..." The lights cut out, plunging her into darkness, aside from the candlelight. To her right, the door jolts back, bashing the wall and making her jump. She feels movement behind her, inhales a cocktail of unfamiliar scents. Lemon, vanilla, something else she can't place. "Mart?" He says nothing, but she feels his touch. A lingering caress from her temple across her cheek towards her mouth. She starts to turn towards him. His hand clumps across her lips and nose, yanking her backwards. She braces against them, lashes out with her hands, trying to break free. Fails.